All please rise.
Good morning. Y'all can be seated. Thank you very much. Justices Kelly and Smith and myself want to welcome you to the Third Court of Appeals. We've only got one case set in this docket hour today, and that is 0321258 CV, Railroad Commission of Texas and Magnolia Oil and Gas Operating LLC versus the Opelias. And I apologize if I've mispronounced that name. I even did Google. But I'm not sure if I did it right, so I'm sure I will be corrected later in this proceeding. This matter is being recorded and also shown live on YouTube. I will apologize to begin with. Our YouTube feed in the first proceeding today was not that great, but I can tell you that our audio is separate from the YouTube feeding, so our audio should be clear. And it will be available on the court's website later on this afternoon, as well as whatever quality our YouTube broadcast shows. It is what it is, and we hope that the public can view this important proceeding today. For anyone that's new to the Third Court, and many of you are not, each side is allocated 20 minutes, and Mr. Kyle has already visited with the parties on that, and typically the appellant gets to reserve some time for rebuttal. So the appellants have advised us that for the parties, Ms. Hubenak will begin at 7 minutes, and then Justice Phillips will argue for another 9 minutes. Then the appellees for the Opelias will take their full 20, and then we'll reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. We have, as you know, a time warning system, and when the light turns yellow, you'll have 2 more minutes to argue. When it turns red, please wrap up your comments. The justices may have some questions of you and give you additional time at their discretion, but hopefully you'll be able to wrap up at that red light. I would ask that counsels introduce themselves and announce ready for the record.
Yes. Sully Hubenak with the Texas Attorney General's Office representing the Railroad Commission of Texas, and we are ready to proceed.
Thank you.
Tom Phillips and Travis Gray for Magnolia Oil and Gas Office.
John McFarland for the Opelias, and we're ready.
All right, thank you very much. And with that, Ms. Hubenak, you may proceed.
May it please the court. The commission acted within its authority when it decided, in the context of a contested case, that it would uphold the permit that had been issued to Magnolia Oil and Gas to drill a production sharing agreement well. In the context of a contested case, on the administrative record, the commission decided that Magnolia Oil and Gas had a good faith claim to drill and operate a well on a drilling unit that was comprised of 3 separate tracks. The permitting of production sharing agreement wells is done based on the plain language of the commission's existing rules and forms. The Commission's existing rules and forms provide a method for permitting those wells, and the wells are also subject to policies that the Commission has adopted and established and been consistently applying. This case is different from the case heard by the court in the first case, where there is events surrounding a one-time event. The policies of the Commission for production sharing agreement wells and allocation wells have been consistently applied for over a decade. First of all, to permit a production sharing agreement well.
What was the difference between the time that the commission developed Form 12 in 2011 under APA rulemaking? What's the difference between that and the amended Form 16? Why could you skip rulemaking now, but you had to do rulemaking before when you developed PSA 12?
Actually, the P-Form P-16 also went through rulemaking. That rule was that Form P-16 was put into place when Rule 40 was amended through regular rulemaking procedures under, you know, with publication in the Texas Register. That Form P-16, there was a reference to it in the proposal and also in the adoption that took the public to a place where they could get a copy of it. So even the P-16 was adopted in compliance with APA rulemaking, and that's based on the Texas Supreme Court of Workers' Compensation versus Patient Advocates, where they looked at that provision in that if the Texas Register, they can allow for information to be admitted from the proposal or the publication and just have a reference where someone can get a copy of it. So even the P-16 was adopted in compliance.
Ms. Hubenack, how could one comment then if it's on the website? What's the process for someone providing a public comment if it's just listed on the website?
They could comment in response to the proposal the proposal in the Texas Register. They can submit comments that way. They can also comment on the website. So there's both those ways. But when that P-16 was referenced in the Texas Register, a person could have commented to the commission just as you comment anytime there is a proposal in the Texas Register.
And for what period of time?
I don't recall what period of time, Your Honor. I can follow up with a post-submission letter that gives you that, but there's a standard period of time. I think it's a minimum 30 days comment that you must provide, but I want to be certain of that. So the rules, the commission's rules, Rule 5 is the basic permitting well, where someone is required to apply with a W-1. The W-1 has boxes on it where you can check allocation well, you can check production sharing agreement well, you can check I'm filing for a pooled well. So that form is used. Then the commission relies on Rule 86, which is adopted and sets up definitions and guidelines for horizontal wells. And then I've referred already to Rule 40, subsection I, which requires the submission of a Form P-16. And that Form P-16 has gone through rulemaking. Now, the current Form P-16 has the same substantive information. I think it's been amended once since then. Same substantive information, but it was just a formatting change. That would not require republication.
And which of the forms actually informs people of the 65%? Which one of them has it in the form itself?
That is in the instructions to Form P-16.
Was it in both of them, in the first one and the amended, or just the amended?
The final version of the instructions to the Form P-16 in 2016 included a definition of allocation well and production sharing agreement well. And as we put it in our brief, that was guidance for operators to have information about how they could apply for wells. Those definitions set out in the instructions are the same definitions the Commission's been using since 2008 when it adopted established the 65% as a minimum interest for production sharing agreement wells. It did that in an open meeting in a docket where it was considering whether to permit a well. You've seen the minutes. That docket is listed under the protested section of the Commission's business that day.
But in Form PSA 12, the 65% was not mentioned either.
It was
in the
not.
Form. Okay.
You're correct, Your Honor. By the time the form was adopted, it was being used for production sharing agreement wells. As I've said in the brief, the Texas Register notice for the PSA 12 specifically stated that the form was being adopted intentionally to get data on production sharing agreement wells. Based on the record before, so the rules of the commission provide for permitting of a production sharing agreement well. There is no requirement that the commission have a specific rule just for production sharing agreement or allocation wells. And then based on the evidence and the record, the commission determined that Magnolia had a good faith claim to drill the well. And that was their commission's interpretation of their Rule 15. Rule 15 is the definition of good faith claim. It is based on the 1943 Texas Supreme Court case that sets out the boundaries of the commission. It allows the commission to find a good faith claim. but it prohibits the commission from addressing any issues regarding title or possessory interest.
Even when they're the Magnolias, the lessee for all the tracts of land, including the Opelia's tract of land, so they know what's in the contract and they know the contract says no pooling whatsoever in the Opelia's, there's still good faith. And Magnolia knows what's in the lease.
The reason it's still good faith, if I may proceed.
Yes, ma'am, you may, please.
Yeah, the reason it's good faith is because this is a contested case proceeding. So you have a substantial evidence standard of review. And the commission had an opinion from a legal scholar that pooling was not required. And based on that opinion, the commission decided that they would not require pooling for the permitting of wells. That is also consistent with the language in the 1943 Magnolia Oil and Gas case. Because in that case, what the Texas Supreme Court said is, the permit may be perfectly valid as far as conservation laws, yet the right to drill and produce may depend upon a suit filed at the courthouse. And that's what the, and I apologize too if I'm mispronouncing the Opelia's, but that's what the Opelia's have done by going to Karnes County and suing Magnolia for breach of contract. That is their business. That is what the commission says. That any dispute about the ability to drill this well under the commission's conservation rules is if it is a violation of their lease, that's for a court to decide. The Texas Supreme Court has said that we cannot.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Justice Phillips.
May it please this honorable court, Magnolia will propose to discuss two matters before the court today. The first starts where Chief Justice Burns' questions left off, which is, can the Railroad Commission properly conclude that an oil and gas operator has shown a good faith claim to drill a multi-lease horizontal well if it does not have pooling agreements on all those leases? And the second question is, did the commission's procedures comply with administrative law in terms of how this PSA permit was articulated? And in that discussion, I will primarily concentrate on the commission's adjudicatory functions whereby policy can be made either by rule or by contested case decision. The Opelia's, and I know a person who uses that name, so that's just what I've always called it. The Opelia's insist that the only way to drill a multi-lease horizontal well is for each lessor to agree to pooling. No pooling, no drilling, they say. But that's wrong. The Magnolia lease gives the operator a fee simple, determinable ownership in all the minerals underlying the Opelia's tract, subject only to the 1/8 royalty on any product that's extracted. The lease is silent about whether any wells drilled have to be vertical or horizontal, nor do they restrict Magnolia's rights to drill on an adjacent tract. The Opelia's point out correctly that their lease prohibits pooling, but an operator can drill a horizontal well and achieve production on multiple leases without pooling. That's because pooling is a very different animal from what we have in this case. The sine qua non of pooling is that all the lessors agree to share revenues, generally but not always based on the acreage, their acreage that's in the pooling unit. So regardless of whether a well is drilled on their property or not, and regardless of whether there's a drop of anything produced under their land, they get a proportionate share of the royalty. There are also other reasons why pooling is different, and they're laid out at some length in the Texoga's amicus brief. But none of that is present here. The Opelia's are going to get the production that occurs under their lease, no more, no less. And so it is the antithesis of a pooled well. And Professor Ernie Smith's Law Review article, which we've attached in our bench book, explains that at some length, and most of the commentators have agreed with him. Since 1943, when the Supreme Court decided that Magnolia decision that's tab G in the bench book, The standard for granting permits has been whether the operator reasonably appears to have a good faith claim in the property. The commission correctly determined that Magnolia had a good faith claim, and therefore the district court's judgment should be reversed. The commission's decision was not only legally correct, but it serves the constitutional and statutory goals of development and conservation. On many of the older fields, 60, 70-year-old leases that have been kept in force, there are now many royalty owners, and it would be impossible to track every one of them down and get a separate pooling agreement if pooling was not in the original lease. Furthermore, a number of these leases have already had vertical wells drilled on them. They've been pooled in different units at different depths, and working through all that to develop a horizontal pooling agreement would also be a formidable, if not impossible, task. Now, in my remaining time, I want to talk about the procedures, which is what most of the court's questions were about. Magnolia, in its brief, has explained why Rules 5, 40I, and 86 standing alone were sufficient to grant these permits, and that's definitely true with an allocation well. There's nothing that's been changed following Professor Smith's logic, following the Browning case from this court, nothing that would require extra rulemaking. The Permian Basin Petroleum Association's brief, which we just got yesterday, has a detailed discussion of ad hoc adjudicatory functions of an administrative agency and explains in detail why the commission has been following this 65% rule for a production sharing agreement since 2008 in the Devon case. Magnolia wants to spend its time with another somewhat narrower argument that it believes would definitely carry the day, even if you believe there's a problem under the APA or as a general rule with adjudicatory function of an agency. And that special thing is that the Railroad Commission has enabling statutes that uniquely empower it to decide public policy in its, and this is a Supreme Court quote, informed discretion between either rulemaking or an order. Citing numerous sections of the Texas Natural Resources Code, in Railroad Commission versus Lone Star Gas, tab H of the bench book, the Supreme Court explained that the legislature created a dual system of oil and natural gas regulation in which the commission possesses both rulemaking and adjudicatory powers. Then in 2003, in Railroad Commission versus WBD Oil and Gas, which is tab J, Justice Heck further expounded on that and said, both decisions and rules have the force of law. And while it may often be true that a contested case decision affects only the relatively few parties involved in a case, while a rule has much broader effect, that is not necessarily so. Some cases, like the one before the court in 2003 and like this one, affect a large number of persons under a contested case decision, even more than some rules. Moreover, to the extent that a contested case decision has precedential value for similar cases, its effect may be similar to a rule. So both the statutory text and the Railroad Commission versus Lone Star lays out 15 or 16 different sections of the Natural Resources Code that confer power on the Railroad Commission. Both those statutes and these opinions from the Supreme Court, I think, give a unique status to the Railroad Commission. I've not found any other agency that grants this broad a power to make policy under contested case hearings as the legislature has given to the Railroad Commission.
I think CUC would argue with you on that.
Well,
they're all gone,
so and we read the PUC's rules, and I'm not saying, all I'm saying is they're not this broad, as best I can tell. And after this court writes, you may prove that. You may prove me wrong.
So are you saying that in any contested case hearing that the commissioners could come up with a new rule and that's because it was announced or adjudicated in a contested case proceeding, then there's no APA violation for any rule that comes out of
that's
a contested case?
That's the clear teaching of WBD and these other cases. Now, That has precedential value, and if the commission never follows it again, it doesn't have the same force and effect of a rule. But the commission has been granting allocation well and PSA well permits virtually on a daily basis. They don't meet every day, but on a weekly basis, they grant numerous ones of these types of permits. They have followed the 65% rule consistently since 2008. If an operator wants a PSA permit, it is in effect the same as an allocation permit, except that you show you have a certain threshold of agreement among all the lessors, which would lead one to believe there's less chance of litigation, and therefore an investor might have more confidence in going into this well if they know their profits aren't going to be eaten up by some lawsuit.
And remind me, Justice Phillips, is the 65% on the acreage, is it established on the acreage of the lease, that, or is it on the production?
Well, that depends on the agreement, and in this case, different agreements provided for different things. Mm-hmm. The Springer Ranch decision of this court discussed a production well, which was, it was the productive part of the horizontal from beginning to end, and how many linear feet went under each lease. And some of our agreements are that way, some are acreage. There are three or four ways that an operator can decide how to allocate in any production. A PSA well will have, the lessor and lessee will have agreed upon one of those measurements. An allocation well,
only 65% will have agreed.
65%
will have agreed. So that 35% person is just out. They don't get to negotiate.
34.99 has the right to go to a district court in the state of Texas, as indeed the OPLs have done here.
I have a question about the good faith claims. So the good faith claims, are those on the face of the documents? Like, who makes that determination, obviously?
Yep. The Railroad Commission, since the Magnolia case, has had no power to go behind the face of a document and make a title decision. No, it's not part of their job in granting a permit to say, we don't think this lease is valid. We don't think you're really the owner of the lease. You're not really the lessee. If facially it's valid, the Supreme Court tells the commission not to do a useless act if it's apparent to anybody. Says this, well, this lease will expire in 5 years and it's 10 years later. But if there's any doubt about it, as here, where Ernie Smith and a number of other commentators say you don't need to pool in order to drill these horizontal wells, then the Railroad Commission is not only empowered but arguably required to grant that permit. And they grant these permits with a caveat that this is a legal decision that awaits a final determination in the courts of the state.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Certainly. And let's hear from the appellees. Yes, sir.
May it please the court. We are here because the Railroad Commission has effectively nullified a unique and fundamental principle of Texas oil and gas law. It's a principle that this court reaffirmed in Browning Oil v. Lukey, and that principle is a lessee cannot pool without the lessor's express authorization. And in Lukey, this court reaffirmed that principle in the context of horizontal drilling.
So how do you respond to Justice Phillips? Pooling is drastically different than a PSA and the other type of well.
Well, what I would say to that is that the only authority that they cite in support for that argument is our law review articles, and those law review articles are contrary to this court's holding in Lukey. In Lukey, the court said a lessee that wants to drill a multi-tract horizontal well and lacks pooling authority has two options. It could seek to negotiate with its lessor for increased pooling authority, or it can forego drilling. This court did not say there's a third option. You could just drill the well and then allocate royalties with reasonable certainty.
I guess that brings me to a question. What is the effect if we uphold the judgment to all the other wells that and leases that might be out there that cover this same type of allocation and PSA permits?
No, Your Honor. Those permits, presumably the time for challenging the permits has expired, and Texas law has robust protections for lessees that pay royalties. In Hooks v. Samson, the Supreme Court said that a lessor had ratified a pooled unit by accepting royalties from the pooled unit. So there, this argument that if you affirm this case as to the Opiela's permit, Texas energy production will somehow be imperiled is not true.
But you would agree that if we find in your favor, then all the other permits that are being processed today, tomorrow, the next day, next week, would all have to come to a grinding halt, right?
Well, I would agree that the commission would have to go through formal rulemaking, which is what the APA requires, and the operators may be required to negotiate with their lessors, which is what Texas law requires. APA rulemaking doesn't necessarily need to be burdensome. Amicus, Professor Beal, I think, correctly argues that if there really is some urgent need for a rule, the commission could engage in emergency rulemaking. I'd like to discuss one point that my friend on the other side made, and she said that the commission has consistently applied these principles throughout time, and that's not accurate. In fact, the first time the commission faced the issue of allocation wells, the hearings examiners said, we can't do this, it's tantamount to pooling. And it said at page 242 of volume 3 of the reporter's record, such a practice would be unprecedented in commission practice and would far exceed the commission's statutory authority. In adopting the rules for allocation wells, the commission had to overrule its previous precedent. And that's one reason why it is, in fact, a rule. The APA broadly defines the term rule as an agency statement that interprets, implements, or prescribes law or policy. The commission's decision that pooling authority was not necessary to issue permits for allocation wells was certainly implementation of a new policy, and it was an interpretation of law. It was an interpretation that was contrary to some of its own precedents. And in reaching that conclusion, the commission had to overrule its own hearings examiners in the Klotzman case. It had to decide that it didn't need to follow Lukey as part of the permitting process, had to overrule the objections of the General Land Office, also in the Klotzman case. That is a rule. And as far as the 65% requirement for PSA wells, I think that's plainly a rule. It's even hard to describe it without calling it a rule.
And how do you square that with the adjudicatory effect of Devon?
Well, that is a good question. The Supreme Court has never held that the Railroad Commission can adopt rules of general applicability through ad hoc rulemaking. The seminal case on ad hoc rulemaking is Rodriguez. It's a 1999 opinion in which the Supreme Court said ad hoc rulemaking applies only to exceptional circumstances. In Witcher, this court expanded on Rodriguez and said that Rodriguez imposed stringent requirements on ad hoc rulemaking. I think it's noteworthy that neither Magnolia nor the commission cite a single post-Rodriguez case that affirmed an ad hoc rulemaking. The two cases that they rely on the most, and it's the two cases that Justice Phillips referred this court to, are Lone Star and WBD. Neither case supports their argument. In Lone Star, the commission, the Railroad Commission, had gone through APA rulemaking. And a pipeline company that felt it was aggrieved by the rulemaking said, hey, that's not fair. This rulemaking directly affects me. I should have been entitled to personal notice. I should have been allowed to go forward with a contested case, put on evidence, cross-examine witnesses under oath. And the Supreme Court said, no, APA rulemaking is fine. And it did say that whether the commission goes to APA rulemaking or adjudicatory process is within the discretion of the commission, but the Supreme Court in the very next paragraph said, at page 689, when an agency faces the alternative of proceeding by rulemaking or by adjudication, the process of rulemaking should be utilized except in those cases when there is a danger that its use would frustrate the effective accomplishment of the agency's function. That is.
And what about conservation? They're going to be arguing that, you know, their job is to stop waste in the oil and gas industry, and that that's the their one of their core functions.
One, I don't agree with the notion that allocation in PSA wells reduce waste. I think in one of our responses to the amicus briefs, we point that out. The other thing I would say to that is they are required to achieve their regulatory function by complying with the APA. So if they are going to adopt rules of general applicability, like the PSA rule or the allocation well rule, they need to go through the APA. And just because the commission subjectively believes that that rule would prevent waste, it doesn't relieve it of its obligation of taking in public comment, of providing its reasoned justifications for the rule. For example, when the legislature was considering a statute that would have legalized allocation wells, the General Land Office and the University of Texas System, both of which manage vast swaths of minerals for the state of Texas, they said this statute will cost the state of Texas hundreds of millions of dollars in royalties each year. Had the commission gone through the APA rulemaking process, it would have had to grapple with those statements from other state agencies.
In your view, when was the first APA violation? When did it start? Was that with the PSA 12 form? Was it with the P16 form? In the chronology, where do you believe it began?
So one of the problems with this case is it's hard to pin down, sort of big bang moment for when allocation wells and PSA wells occurred. One of the reasons for that is because of the commission's failure to adhere to the APA, as Professors Smith and Weaver explain in their treatise. These rules developed quietly because they were hidden from public view. So I know the other side faults us for saying, well, they don't point to a single action. But to answer the question, when the commission decided that 65% was good enough, and that was in the 2-1 vote in 2008 for Devon, that was an invalid rule under the APA. For allocation wells, it was whenever it decided, contrary to its previous decision, that pooling authority was not necessary. That was also an invalid rule under the APA. It's not clear when exactly that happened. In the Klotzman proposal for decision, the commissioners noted that by the time of the Klotzman case, there had already been, a couple dozen or maybe more allocation wells already drilled. So it was already a rule even before the Klotzman contested case.
And so why are we fighting about rules that are, 12 years old now? Why is this fight timely?
It's timely. If I understand the question to be referring to the other side's limitations argument, I'd like to point out that limitations was not raised either at the commission or at the district court. But it's timely because we timely challenged a permit that relied on invalid rules. In Witcher, the invalid rule apparently had been in place for 30 years, and yet Witcher was able to challenge an agency decision that was based on that invalid rule. This case is no different.
Thank you.
I'd like to turn now to the good faith claim standard. The good faith claim standard, while the Supreme Court in Magnolia held that the Railroad Commission does not have authority to make binding determinations of property or contractual rights, subsequent precedents make clear that the commission, in deciding whether a good faith claim has been made, has a duty to look at the relevant documents and apply Texas law to them. A recent decision is this this court's decision in Rowland, where the operator was alleging that it had a good faith claim to continue to operate a lease because of a force majeure clause in the lease. Interpretation of a force majeure clause is clearly a legal interpretation that would usually be litigated in a court, in a district court. And yet the commission said, applying this unambiguous contract to unambiguous Texas law, there is no good faith claim here. And here, the commission should have done that exact same thing. Could have looked at the lease, which plainly prohibits pooling in any manner whatever. And then it could have looked at this court's decision on Lukey and said, well, Lukey says you had two options. You could have gotten pooling authority, or you could have, or you could forego drilling.
What about the argument? Oh, excuse me. Sorry. You go ahead and finish if you want.
But that is not a good faith claim to drill a well.
My question was, well, what about the argument that the PSA and allocation wells aren't pooling? They're completely different animals.
I disagree with that. We cite to our own law review article written by Professor Brett Wells, in which he convincingly says they're the same thing. And the reason they're the same thing is they share all the same key attributes. One thing to keep in mind is that pooling is itself a creature of the commission's regulations. So when you, the key definition of pooling, and it was the definition that was common back in 1955 when the OPLS lease was executed, was pooling is the combination or aggregation of multiple tracks into a single drilling unit. Allocation and PSA wells do that. And in fact, when an operator drills an allocation or a PSA well, the entire drilling unit is given its own unique lease ID number at the Railroad Commission. The Railroad Commission treats it as a single lease, and that's exactly what happens with pooling. Another thing is the other side will argue that allocation wells and PSA wells don't change the way royalties are distributed. And that is not true, because when a well is drilled entirely on your property, it gets metered entirely on your property, and you know exactly how much production has come from your property. For allocation and PSA wells, you're given an estimate of how much production came from your property, and it may be accurate, it might not be accurate. So that is a key similarity between the two types of wells. Also with pooled unit wells, pooled unit wells are deemed to drain minerals from all the properties in the pooled unit from a common reservoir. And that's exactly what horizontal wells do. They drain minerals from a common reservoir underlying all the properties and then distribute the royalties, not according to how much actually came from each property. We cite some authority in our brief that says it's impossible to accurately gauge how much property has how much oil has come from each property in a horizontal well. But in any event, that's the sort of thing that the commission should have grappled with in a rulemaking proceeding.
I want to shift, to what happens next. If we agree with you that there's been a violation of the APA, in your brief you just say, affirm the district court's judgment. But the district court's judgment doesn't specify what rules have been created in violation of the APA. So if we agree with that argument, what should we do in your view?
The district court remanded for proceedings consistent with the district court's judgment, and that is that the permit was invalid because it was based on invalid rules.
But my point is, it just says erred in adopting rules for allocation and production sharing agreement. So what? How is the Railroad Commission to know what rules have been found in violation of the APA and which ones have not been found in violation of the APA?
Well, to be clear, none of the Commission's APA-compliant rules say anything about allocation or PSA wells. I know the other side referred this court to the 2016 adoption of Form P16. There was a rulemaking in P16. And that rulemaking did refer to Form P16, but it specifically said that the adoption of Form P16 was not part of the proposal. It specifically excluded it from the rulemaking. And the instructions and definitions to the 2016 version of Form P16 they actually said nothing about PSA and allocation wells. We cite to the 2016 version of both the form and the instructions, and they said nothing about PSA or allocation wells. The only version that does say anything about those wells is the 2019 version, and that was not adopted through APA rulemaking. So on remand, the commission needs to go to its APA compliant rules, and under the commission's APA compliant rules, there is only one way to combine multiple tracts for the purpose of creating a single drilling unit, and that is by filing a certificate of pooling authority. And in this case, Magnolia cannot file a certificate of pooling authority because it does not have pooling authority.
What about Rule 80?
The Rule 80 is the commission rule that says when we adopt forms, we don't need to comply with the APA.
And what's your view on that?
That's clearly incompatible with the APA. It would be like the legislature passing a statute that accepts it from the Constitution. The APA governs anything the commission does, and it cannot, by rule, create exceptions to the APA. And to the extent the commission is using its own in-house forms adoption process to shoehorn new rules, that's not proper. I'm running low on time, so I'd like to make one clarification. In Magnolia's reply brief at page 24, Magnolia asserts that the OPLs have not been prejudiced because they continue to receive their royalties. There's no cite to the record for that assertion, and that's because there's nothing in the record to support it, and in fact, it's not accurate. The OPLs have not received any royalties from the audio slave well. And that's in part because, as I mentioned earlier, the Supreme Court's decision in Hooks, which says you accept royalties from a pooled unit, you ratify it. So I'd like to close by saying the APA matters. The APA exists to give ordinary individuals like my clients, the OPLs, an opportunity to have a say in the shaping of state policy. And the procedures that the commission used to adopt these policies are just completely contrary to that. Because of the procedure that was used, the only individuals that had a say were the oil and gas operators that are at the commission applying for permits. That's just fundamentally unfair and runs afoul of the APA. And for those reasons, we'd ask this court to affirm.
Thank you very much. Ms. Hubinette, yes, ma'am.
Your Honors, the commission is applying policies that it adopted in 2008 and 2013, the Klotzman case and the 65%, and they have applied those consistently. I want to remind the court this is a substantial evidence review case, and there is substantial evidence supporting the commission's decision in this case to go with the legal scholar's opinion that pooling is not required and to go with the 65%. In answer to Justice Kelly's question about can the agency just change its mind, your Encore case, this court's Encore case in 2013 specifically said in that case, PUC, you've got to consistently apply a policy, and if you're going to vary from it, you have to explain varying from it. In this contested case, the commission applied the policy. In the next contested case, will they find that there's a reason why 64% would be good? That's a possibility, but they haven't done that since 2008. The Browning case from this court, it does not say that you have to pool to drill a horizontal well. That opinion, you'll see both Magnolia and in our briefing, we take issue with that broad reading of the Lukey case. What it involved was invalid pooling, and the court there said what the commission is saying, if you don't pool, you must pay the royalty owner based on the tract, and that is what is required of Magnolia in a production sharing agreement well. When they haven't an agreement of how to allocate, they have to pay them based on that tract. And that's separate and apart from what the commission deals with. We just took away the regulatory bar. What the OPLs are asking the court, what the district court is asking, is for the commission to go outside the authority that they got in Magnolia. that they are directing the commission to look at pooling clauses, relevant title leases, and anything that might affect whether they have pooling. That is not the commission's business. As I cited the very language from Magnolia, we removed the regulatory bar. That case is a short case, but so much of the wordage in that Magnolia case from the Texas Supreme Court clearly says, it's a negative pronouncement. You're giving them a permit. They get to drill the well. And as Justice Byrne points out, it's a conservation measure. The commission's duty, you look to the coastal opinion from the Texas Supreme Court that we discuss in our brief, the Texas Supreme Court recognized how broad the commission's authority is. So I also draw the attention, I go back to the commission has choices, it's informed discretion. That's the Lone Star case and the WBD. It gets to choose. And this court's Brinkley case on rules, it also recognized that there's informed discretion of agencies to choose. And the Brinkley case draws a comparison, saying adjudicatory, contested case decisions are equal to rulemaking, if you look at that language in that case. So the commission found good faith claim based on substantial evidence. They had valid leases. That's a difference with the Roland case. The Roland case, they found the lease had terminated. What is it the commission looks for in a production sharing agreement? Well, you have to have a valid lease. That's what they look for. If you have a valid lease, if you have 65%, if you have fulfilled the permitting applications, you get a permit, and then you fight at the courthouse, what is the problem with your lease? The final thing, Browning, the commission's decision to abide by the Magnolia case in this decision is supported by substantial evidence, and under the substantial evidence of review, it should be affirmed. That there was a good faith claim, they followed what they had done, they applied policies they had consistently been applying, and any attack on the rules, you're right, there's a limitations error at time, and that's a jurisdictional issue possibly, and so you can't waive that. I draw your attention to the final brief by Mr. Bennett. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsels, all of you. Thank you very much. The court will stand in recess, and we'll get back with you as timely as we can. Thank you so much. We'll stand in recess.